Now, explain to us, first of all, what does this mean by binary partner?
Well, it was, I believe, George Gatewood, astronomer George Gatewood, that first came up with the idea that maybe most stars are binaries. And a lot of stars, we can see the binary companion or the double star system because both stars are ignited. In our case, our hypothetical binary companion, which I actually believe does exist, is what's called a brown dwarf star or a dark star. And usually they're thought to be on the order of maybe 5% solar mass. But I believe in our case, it's a very, very small one, maybe half the size of Jupiter.
Okay. All right. So, and when you say it is dark, that means it has it is emitting no energy like our sun at all. What's its mass like, Barry? I mean, is it solid? Does it have rock on it? What is that if it's dark?
We think it is mostly heavy elements. We don't think it's cloudy. We think it's magnitude about 21 or 22, so it's a very, very, very faint object. It's not something you can see with your store-bought telescopes, even the very good ones that amateur astronomers use. Or at least we don't think it can be seen by such telescopes. It would take a very large telescope, like a 100-inch telescope or above, to see it, and even they would have to make a whole night exposure. As to what's covering it, well, with my luck, it'll be black or red. we don't know what it's really made of, other than we suspect it's made of mostly heavy elements. That means it's made up of elements that are not hydrogen or not helium.
Now, there are a number of theorists and physicists who believe exactly the way you do that this sun has a partner. So you're not alone in this anymore. It's growing, isn't it?
Right. It's growing. But perhaps we are just a little bit different than the bulk of the other people that feel that way, in that we think that for planetary systems to form around stars, they don't form in the conventional way of just simple dust cloud condensation as has been espoused for years in the astronomical community. We think that they're formed with the aid of these, of the companion star, in this case, our unlit companion star, which we've dubbed Vulcan, who really, the name was taken from Madame Blavatsky's work, and she was the one that kind of tipped us off to this, and she was the one that suggested that the planets are seeded, and we agree with her, and we've built a theory around this, with the seeds being Dr. Stephen Hawking, the great British physicist, his primordial black holes. And this core theory pervades our thesis of both planetary formation, the existence of Vulcan, and nominally what orbital inclination and things like that it should be found at.
Vulcan, huh? How'd we get that name specifically from her? Because is that where they picked it up for Star Trek?
Well,
isn't that where Spock was from?
I think that Star Trek did adopt that idea, that concept. But Madame, and astronomically, astronomers used to feel that Vulcan existed as a planet, but it existed in between Mercury and the Sun. So it's very, very close to the Sun because its name implied warmth or heat. But we adopted the name Vulcan because we initially approached this problem by trying to see how it might affect what's called avatars. And this is a very new approach, but it all winds up... It all boils down to the same thing. We're trying to get the orbit elements for Vulcan. And the orbit elements, of course, are the mathematical quantities that describe how Vulcan moves about the sun. And in this case, we needed some data from the avatars, and that's how we initially approached the problem. We don't have access to huge telescopes like astronomers have, so we can't really point it at Vulcan, and indeed, even if we did have them, There'd be some doubt if we could actually get time on the telescopes to point or to search the sky where we think it would be.
And Barry, you're no slouch. I mean, you've got a PhD, you're a doctor, you've got this degree in physics. I mean, you're pretty credentialed for you to believe this and some others in your field to begin to believe this. Somebody's got to start noticing this. And, you know, we start moving these telescopes one way or another to see if we can find Vulcan, right?
Well, it would be very, very handy to do so. And I believe there was actually a dedicated search for it back in the early 1980s. And it was they used the IRIS satellite to look for it. And the IRIS satellite... there's a children's encyclopedia, it turns out. I guess the new science and invention encyclopedia that has an actual illustration of what we call Vulcan. And they call it a dead star and Planet X. And in that encyclopedia, they have this dead star depicted as a body about 50 billion miles away. And if you compare that to our Vulcan at Aphelion, our Vulcan at Aphelion is about 41 billion miles away. So these two numbers are more or less coincident for a body that's hypothetical at this point. They also have a body called Planet X. And Planet X is depicted as being 4.7 billion miles away. That turns out to be about 50 astronomical units.
I want to talk with you about that and Vulcan tonight, Barry,
okay,
because Planet X has haunted a lot of us over the past few years, not really appearing, but a lot of people believe it's out there. And we're going to have to pull out some of the past work of Zechariah Sitchin when we talk about Planet X tonight as well. Now, in this particular case, and we'll call it Vulcan tonight,
okay,
did it ever fire up as a star in its infancy?
We don't think so. We think its mass is really far, far, far too low for it to have ever radiated by hydrogen ignition or even by gravitational contraction. Gravitational contraction of a star is another way for it to emit energy. But this body is just too small. Our estimates originally started out, like I said, about 5% solar mass. And as our work progressed, they quickly decreased to about the mass of Jupiter and then to about half the mass of Jupiter.